Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. In her new book, Skin Theory, Visual Culture and the Postwar Prison Laboratory, from NYU Press, Christina Vesperis offers a model of an abolitionist approach to STS and the history of the life sciences. And it's kind of what I needed right now. So by now, this is well known. During the 1960s, scientists with faculty appointments at Penn and with contracts from pharmaceutical companies did experiments on captive men at Philadelphia's Holmesburg Prison. Building on this documentary work, Vesperis turns attention to the prison experiment's optical rationality, or the way of seeing images that came out of the space that was simultaneously a prison and a laboratory. Vesperis shows how skin operated as a scientific apparatus, and she also uses skin as a metaphor for how science makes race visible, and yet it leaves racism as a void. So at its core, the book asks, what is the relationship between science and the project of freedom? And it hopes towards a reparative bioethics that dismantles scientific racism and the prison nation that it upholds. This interview is a collaborative effort among myself, Laura Stark, and the graduate students at Vanderbilt University in the seminar, Critical Bioethics. Well, this is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University and the graduate students in the course Critical Bioethics. And it's a real pleasure to be talking today with Christina Vesperis, the author of the new book, Skin Theory, Visual Culture and the Postwar Prison Laboratory. And just in terms of the nuts and bolts, this book is about the Holmesburg Prison in Pennsylvania and about the long-term and wide range research of Dr. Kligman, who was a dermatologist, well-known at this point. He was specifically a specialist in fungal infections, but I think some of his work has been best known through the work and the testimony of Alan Hornsbloom and the book Acres of Skin and the more recent book that came out of that. What's remarkable, as you sort of recite in the introduction of this book, is that 33 pharmaceutical companies had contracts at this prison for research, that around 85 to 90% of the prison population was Black, and 75% of the prison population was used in medical experiments. And what you want to do in this book, as we were reading it, sort of coming from a critical bioethics and an STS perspective, was also think in the direction of media studies and what you're referring to as the optical rationality that's undergirding the experiments. And so the organizing question for the book is about science and the project of freedom, and thinking about how scientific racism persists. And you have this very moving quotation in the introduction that the atrocity of scientific racism is not that it happened, but that it happened again and again. And so you're interested in this optical rationality to try to understand how scientific racism can be built into the core of a lot of scientific work. So in this book, you hold together two institutions, the prison and the scientific laboratory. And in Holmesburg, the two come together. So I wonder if you could start us off then by talking about skin and thinking through the title of the book, Skin Theory. So how does skin constitute an object of all of the gazes of the wardens, of the scientists? And at the same time, how does it structure those gazes?
Wow. Yeah. So skin is a pretty fluid as an object in the book. And I'll start by first talking about the frameworks that brought me to analyze skin in the particular way I did for the book. One is that I am trained in science and technology studies. And in that field, we don't simply critique scientific practice from the outside, for example. We don't simply make arguments like, here is a culture that is racist or sexist, and then, of course, that is going to filter down into the science that is done. Instead, we look at science as a culture that you could already see in the very practice. It reproduces these forms of oppression, right? That it doesn't need this external influence, that it is kind of shaping our social and natural world on its own. As it's an active participant in that shaping. So that was one framework. The other framework was prison abolition, spearheaded by the work of Black feminist activists and advocates and researchers and scholars. And prison abolition is pretty systemic in its definition of change. It's not simply about getting rid of buildings, prison buildings. It is thinking about the rest of society, how we can transform social relationships that move away from punishment or punitive responses to harm. And so with those frameworks, I brought that into this project and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to get down to the actual science that was being done, or at least how Kligman and his team were communicating it in their publications. So going through their actual methods and seeing how racism was an internal part, was a logic that drove a lot of their questions. And it was very important to me that their experiments didn't really have anything to do with race. They weren't recapitulating questions like, Are Black people biologically inferior? Are white people biologically superior? They weren't rehashing those questions. And yet their experiments were deeply racist. And so the only way to make that argument was to go into the methods. And prison abolition, that is looking at process and not just, buildings helps that, and I think it's conducive to kind of having an STS framework done. Also, I saw them as working together in the analysis. And so when I looked at skin, yes, I was looking at skin as an actual thing, right? How it became an apparatus, how it was a sort of visual medium for screening, for example, pain, or screening changes in skin color in response to an agent that was put on the skin. But I was also thinking about skin a little bit more theoretically. Skin, the ways that skin is has all of these connotations of intimacy and borders and touching. And in that sense, skin is a very important part of subject formation, that our physical appearance marks us in certain ways in society. And so this is a way of sort of making that move of like, here is skin as an objective reality and how it is being taken up in an experiment. But then also how this experiment reproduces all the ways that we talk about physical appearance and skin and the people that are in those skin, how all of that is also informing the practice of science.
That's really helpful. Yeah. And in thinking about the relevance of the two institutions of incarceration and science, one of the things we really appreciated is how you're showing us the ways in which captive skin in particular brings together the invisibility, so the incarceration, the captive aspect, and visibility, so the scientific work in which there's, as you repeat, drawing on people like Dastin and Gallison, the visual bias of the sciences in making things visual in order to make truth. And so skin is this spot within prisons in which there's both this invisibility and this hypervisibility of science as well. In chapter one, you really expand on this, both how the visibility and the invisibility are simultaneous in the work of Kligman, by showing us the way that skin operates as an apparatus. And you're specifically bringing back in photographs that Kligman took in his research that were kind of extreme close-ups of the skin of Black men in the prison that had been exposed to chemicals that actually changed the pigmentation of the skin. And in thinking about the Black skin as an apparatus, what you show us is that even though the viewer is looking at skin, it's not what you're supposed to be seeing. And so it kind of becomes invisible. I mean, it would be like looking at a picture of a microscope instead of, yes, you know, the output, the result, mm-hmm, that the right microscope is showing. So you're staring right at it and yet not seeing what's outside of the frame, which is that this is a person who is Black within the broader prison system, how it's both apparent and completely concealed in the visual methods that are being used. So building on this, Justin had some really interesting thoughts about this issue of intimacy that the photographs were building from and drawing on, and just the possibility of intimacy in these photographs. Justin, take it away.
So in class, one of the things we talked about was how the bureaucratic nature of the prison experiments really made them seem like impersonal and disconnected. But on the other hand, as we sort of touched on just now, was chapter one made the argument that the zoomed in pictures of the experiments in the records and textbooks are extremely intimate. Does that intimacy go away if the pictures are zoomed out, or do you think both the impersonal and intimate natures can coexist?
That's a very good question. And I remember when I was writing that part of the book, I was drawing on a feminist scholarship talking about, close-ups in film, for example. What is the point of the close-up? It's to bring the person closer to the subject of the image, creating this sense of intimacy, right? Trying to explode this distance between the viewer and the subject of the gaze. But here, these experiments were being conducted in prisons where the notion of autonomy is just completely non-existent. So what is the role of skin in a context where you can't rely on it as a form of bounding the self, right? The prison is a space where someone just loses that sense of autonomy of self-determination. And this can be seen in the ways that they are then deployed for scientific research. And we can see it in the actual visual imagery that is produced in science. But here's the thing, a lot of laboratory work, a lot of visualizations that occur in labs, they are close-ups. We, you know, laboratory work tends to look at very, very, very small things. And so they can't help but be close-ups. And so here I'm talking about a standard practice of visualization that happens to coincide with this sort of invasion of a subject, right? The loss of autonomy, the loss of borders that can be construed as intimate, yes, because you are the scientific gaze is being brought closer to the subject of that gaze, but it's a very disturbing kind of intimacy. It's colonizing. It's a touch that is unwelcome and that is coerced. And so that is what I was trying to get at when I was talking about the what intimacy might be in these images.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I should say that the test that you were looking at of Kligman's in chapter one, in particular on skin as an apparatus, are ones that are probably best known to many people as retin A and mm-hmm. various forms of acne and wrinkle treatments. So they're really common and really familiar. And what you're showing is the way in which Black bodies in particular were kind of instrumentalized for pharmaceutical production that was ultimately geared towards a white market in particular. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're clear and you show in the photographs themselves that white skin was also part of the visual apparatus, and it was used in the experiments almost in this teleological way, in which you would have these experiments done on the on Black skin to maximize the witnessing to the exposure, the change that the medication could make to the color of the skin. Mm-hmm. But then its market potential, its success for white bodies. And in chapter two, it seems like they're nice mates, chapter one and chapter two, because you're still focusing on this visibility, invisibility of scientific uses of captive skin in chapter two, which is called Skin Problems. And in this chapter, you're still thinking of skin as an apparatus, but you're looking at the way that skin was explicitly racialized. And in these experiments, you're showing us the studies that were done on allergens in particular, mm-hmm. and you're pointing out sort of on the issue of intimacy that what the photographs were showing, what were these bodies that were not happy, were not comfortable. They were having an allergic reaction that was intentional, that was given to them. And so even though there is this real close-up, there's absolutely no empathetic possibility mm-hmm. in those photographs, even though it's clear that it's a source of harm for the skin, which Kligman acknowledges and actually comes to harness. That is a form of harm and pain. And so on the issue of pain, I'm going to hand it over to Sonali.
Yes. So in chapter two, you write, whereas the skin of Black prisoners constituted a favorable medium for seeing white, when it came to making and viewing images of pain, Black skin hampered perception. Can you explain for listeners how were other races and ethnicities seen in terms of pain?
Yes, of course. Thank you for that question. So in chapter one, I was making that argument that, you know, the skin is an apparatus. And when an apparatus is working just fine, you don't really notice it, right? This is something that is kind of talked a lot about in STS, is that when the apparatus breaks down, that's when you notice it. And that's what I was trying to talk about in chapter two, right? All of a sudden, this visual apparatus stops working as a visual apparatus when the thing that is being visualized is pain. So in this case, Black skin was configured as not being a good screen for visualizing pain, but white skin is better for that, because how scientists defined pain in these studies is mainly redness, pinkness. My book focuses a lot on Black skin because it is situated at Holmesburg, and a majority of the prisoners at Holmesburg were Black. But this was a chapter that is very much in conversation with other literature talking about this long history of ignoring pain in communities of color more broadly. Why is it that the phrase we call it now is medical gaslighting, and it's usually talked about in terms of women across races, that when women go to their doctors, their complaints of pain are not taken seriously. But this particular chapter is speaking to that history where people of color in general, when their complaints of pain, of illness are dismissed. And here I am looking specifically at the skin again, showing that, this isn't a science being or a medical science being negatively influenced by a racist culture. It is also the culture of medical science itself is racist. And so, of course, it's going to produce scientific knowledge and metrics about pain and illness that privileges whiteness or centers harm done to white people.
The chapter also, in terms of the STS and how it wants to think about the STS literature and how it wants to think about harm and the sort of the injustices that continue to be done on Black and brown bodies by taking the white as white code, white category as the anchoring codes for these studies. You also show the way in which the misbehaving skin and even misbehaving prisoners are showing us something about how agency works. And you have some nice thoughts on the challenges of feminist STS post-humanism and that whole literature in this chapter, given that the dehumanization of people in prisons, in many medical and scientific experiments, is so apparent and nothing that we would want to minimize. And so I was kind of curious to know how you end up lining up yourself on the feminist STS post-humanism literature, given your own concerns about dehumanizing effects of this work. So yeah, what do you think? What's your current thinking?
Oof. Hard. So the feminist post-humanist work, and I'm not the only one who's writing about this, but this sort of flight from the human to multi-species or the agency of things, for example. And I didn't know how to sort of engage with that work, because when I think about agency of things, I've always been wondering, how do we theorize agency of dehumanized humans, of people who are rendered animal or people who are rendered things, like I talk about in my book. What is the agency of the thing there? And the problem is, well, then do we just expand the category of the human to include more humans? And in that case, then we say that they have agency, or can we look at this particular space, for example, like the prison, and rethink the human from that space, rethink agency from that space? And we see that it's not easy to do that. It's not easy to theorize agency and empowerment in a space where those things are troubled, if not non-existent.
Okay.
That's where I am. Sorry. Okay. Was that an answer?
Yes. So I take it to be at least one eyebrow raised to the feminist post-humanist literature.
I will say this. It's do we want to theorize, do we want to imagine agency in a prison, or do we want to dismantle the prison? The agency that would come from the prison would probably be reaching towards dismantling. So a bioethics that would be more in line with the principles of prison abolition.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, thank you for that. So building on this issue, I'm going to hand it over to Citlali.
Yes. So the images used in your book really showcase the dichotomy between what is experienced in prison medicine versus what was shown in the media. While the media perceived prisoners' work as helpful and empowering, prisoners were suffering both physically and emotionally. You also discussed that the research subjects would skew the experiments, making Klugman's research work useless. Could the experimentation have led to Black prisoners reclaiming their bodies by creating this economic loss?
Yeah, so that's a good question. It's that's another question about agency, right? The reclamation of the body. I really like that phrase. As I wrote about it in my book, when prisoners would take off the patches on their skin, they took them off in response to the denial of their pain. They would complain that they were in pain, and because it didn't seem like the doctors or the technicians cared about it, they sort of took the patches off because they were in pain. And I think there's something generative about that. The action of taking those patches off simply to feel better, not to, you know, quote unquote, stick it to the man. Maybe that was a motivation. I don't know. Maybe it was an exercise of agency in the sense that they are trying to get back at the doctors who are hurting them. You know, that could be a motivation. I don't know. The only thing I know is that they took it off because they were in pain. And I think that itself, it might look like an unsatisfying theory of agency. But I think there's something there. I use a lot of Fanon in that book. And in Fanon's work, both in Black Skin, White Masks, and Wretched of the Earth, he talks about how colonized subjects would erupt in violence against their colonizers, not because of this dream of a utopian future, decolonized future, not because they have a sophisticated understanding of liberty, you know, but simply because at that moment they couldn't stand it anymore. In one of his books, he uses the phrase, they can't breathe. And so I was thinking a lot about that when I was writing about how the prisoners were taking their patches off. It's because they were simply in pain. And so what does that agency mean, right? An agency that doesn't reach for utopic visions of freedom, but just simply this needs to stop right now.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
Yeah, that's really... Yeah, thank you for that. And the book really has as a through line Fanon's work, and specifically Fanon's discussion of epidermalization of race. And so I've really liked Simone Brown's work on that. And I especially like, given the way you're theorizing skin as an apparatus, how you're taking Fanon and using it as a way to think in terms of American anti-Black racism. So it's really, really, really helpful, very generative. The chapters that anchor the book around skin, so chapters 1 and chapter 2, are so wide ranging in terms of the levels that they're showing us of the prisoner and the ways in which images are reproduced in different kinds of visual culture and materials, and some of them are in mass media and. Mm-hmm. Ones that you show in the book in particular are highlighting the way in which the Holmesburg prison experiments were actually known about. They were written about to a mass audience. Mm-hmm. And it was in terms of the rehabilitative effects of the work that was being done, and showing how prisoners were both serving as test subjects, but they were also doing things like serving as the technicians in the research as well. And so building on this issue, I'm going to hand it over to Halcyon.
In class, we have discussed topics like social control. During the Holmesburg prison experiments, prisoners were not only used as test subjects, but they were also administering many of the tests. Mm-hmm. If inmates were not included in the oversight of experiments in the prison system, would the Holmesburg trials have lasted as long as they did? I'm thinking here about their role in surveillance and monitoring each other. Without prison workers, experiments would not have had that extra level of surveillance that imposed normative behavior. Experiments would have been more expensive, and they also would have been less efficient. I'd like to hear your thoughts on prisoners' role in biopower.
Thank you for that question. That's a very good question. In Alan Hornblum's book, he also mentions that some of his technicians were probably responsible for some of the images that I analyze in my book. We don't know, because when it comes to attributing credit for labor and getting credit for it in published scientific papers, like the Journal of Dermatology, or the Annals of Dermatology, the credit given to prisoners is always when they subjected their bodies to studies, never that they were the technicians that helped these studies come to fruition. And so there's issues of recognizing labor there. Whether I'm not sure if these studies would have lasted longer if it didn't have the captive technicians it relied on. You're right, it would have probably cost more to get free folks to do a lot of this technical administrative work. Prison labor is cheap, but this also sort of kind of showed you how integral the program became in the prison. Holmesburg is not unique in this. A lot of prison programs, a lot of prisons didn't have, you know, jobs programs. The jobs that they had wouldn't have paid all that much. The remuneration for participating in tests, whether as a subject or as a technician, is a lot more than these jobs in prisons. And so the Holmesburg economy started to center this program. It might be that it might not have lasted as long if they didn't think to use the prisoners as technicians. But yes, that was one of the narratives of rehabilitation, that these prisoners who are technicians, they are acquiring important job skills, and they are also learning how to become productive members of society. So inculcating in them a certain sentiment that would perhaps help them return to their communities when they become free. But again, all of this is just like official discourse about the motivations of prisoner technicians and subjects. Most of these prisoners were not yet charged with any crime. They were in prison because they didn't have the money to raise bail. And so it could be that the prisoners were there just to raise money. And so the economic demands of the prisoners kind of run up against this rehabilitative narrative of the prison research program.
Yeah, and in chapter three, you actually take us to think about the skin of architecture. So you take us to the site of Holmesburg itself, and you show how this narrative has a very long history. So you give us the history of what's called the Pennsylvania model, and this is the idea of work and collective labor as well as solitary confinement, so that there's no moral collective degeneration, quote unquote, that this Pennsylvania model around the rehabilitative effects of work, you know, has been going on for a very long time. So Holmesburg itself was built in 1896. It's on 17 acres, and it was modeled on Eastern State. And so that means it's officially a panopticon, I think, if that's correct.
It's almost like one, yes. The hub and spoke design, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the things that you're doing in this chapter is to take us through your own visit to Holmesburg and to think about haunting and the ghosts of Holmesburg, and also just that it was full of garbage.
Yes. And
so thinking through the concept of the ruin in a lot of different ways. And it brings us back to, I think, one of the key points of the book, which is the gaps of memory, and how your aim is not necessarily to fill in gaps and reclaim some memory, but to point out where these holes in memories exist. And the memory is one of sort of the reality of scientific racism. So could you just take us through your visit to the prison?
When I first heard that the prison was still around, I was very intrigued. My first visit to the prison, I didn't look up anything about the prison. I kind of wanted to see what my first impressions were. You know, when you it's open during the summer months, you have to sign a waiver saying that if any structure falls on you, you won't sue the city because it is quite dilapidated. And that's what I wasn't really expecting. Outside, the prison looks like a fortress, you know, it looks like a medieval fortress. No one's getting in, no one's getting out. And inside, everything is just crumbling. And I didn't know how to analyze the space because I was going in there thinking, I'm going to see the lab that I've been, you know, theorizing outside of the space for a whole time. I'm going to see the lab. And I came in and I'm like, everything is falling apart. You know, I'm having literally in that space trouble visualizing the lab that I was theorizing. But there were a lot of photographers there, and they would make jokes like, hey, you know, did you see a ghost yet? Or are you scared? And when they started saying that, I did become scared. You know, the prison guards there don't follow you around while you're in the prison. And so you spend a lot of time on your own, actually. And there are some crevices that are pretty dark. The prison guard there told me not to go anywhere that is kind of blocked off, but I'm small physically. And so that didn't mean anything to me because I could get around, you know, things that are blocked off. After that visit, I was very kind of downtrodden because I didn't know how to hold on to this idea of a lab when that is no longer what the prison was. And then I found out that artists had kind of approach the space in very unique ways. They would photograph it, yes, but they would also make attempts to preserve the walls, the graffiti of the space. And I realized that in a lot of their commentary on their own artwork, they would talk about Kligman's work. They would talk about the skin of the prisoners and make comparisons between that and the crumbling walls of Holmesburg. And here I thought, oh, here's another archive. So in addition to analyzing the scientific publications that Kligman and his team put out, I could also analyze this artistic archive, the cultural artifacts that continue to preserve Holmesburg in our memory. And so that was a different, I would say it was a different kind of analysis that was called for there. I think this is a chapter where I was particularly not very STS because I was my objects were not scientific, except the ghost hunters who would come in with their technology that ostensibly could detect ghostly presence inside the prison, and they would sort of say that this is very rigorous scientific work. This is evidence of ghosts, of phantoms. I sort of had to sort of pause and not immediately have this knee-jerk reaction and say, that's not science. You know, that's not what we do as communication scholars, for example. We take these seriously. So if I thought, well, if that's not, if I could take this seriously as maybe it is science, then how could I analyze it? Because, you know, taking Kligman seriously as a scientist, saying that this is science, and I have a critique around that. I have a strong critique around that. And then I should sort of be able to bring that to this practice of ghost hunting without sort of pejoratively calling it pseudoscience, when I wouldn't call Kligman's work pseudoscience, even though some of his work might be called that.
Great. Yeah, your writing on the prison itself and your experience there is really evocative. Could you say a little bit more on how you think about the ruins and how you're trying to conceptualize a ruin?
Yes, the ruins. There's this is where like a lot of art history and museum studies sort of helped me think about ruins, ruins as history, as ephemeral objects, you know, gesturing to memory, to the flow of time. And I was really having a hard time trying to maintain my STS identity with all of that. But basically, you know, context matters. And so I noticed that, you know, this ruin of Holmesburg, yes, it's that's what it is now. It's not being used to incarcerate anybody now. So functionally, it's not a prison anymore. But it's not exactly, you know, a museum space either. It's not being well preserved like Eastern State is. So what is it now, if it's not the lab that I wanted it to be? You know, it's falling apart. And it made me look to what our prison industrial complex looks like now. Yes, we shut this prison down, but it kind of indexes, ironically, paradoxically, this fantastic rise of the prison industrial complex, right? So this ruin that might be theorized, oh, this is the end of an era. It's actually the beginning of something. And so I talk about it, this ruin, as a model, that this is the iterations of what we now call today the prison industrial complex.
Yeah. That's a really helpful way to think about it, how the ruins, the closing of that one particular site dated from the, you know, the 19th century was an index for the mass incarceration, a huge expansion of prisons right mm-hmm. around that time. And in thinking about the expansion of these kinds of programs, I want to move into chapter four, the last chapter of the book, in which you're thinking about bioethics mm-hmm. and the emergence of the captive test subject as a quote unquote vulnerable subject in American regulation and bioethics in generally, and how this move, what it in part does is actually uphold the possibility of research on incarcerated people. So by creating a set of rules around it, it actually upholds this, the very practice. So actually what I did wanna ask you on the theme of bioethics, not explicitly in this chapter four, was if you could give us a few words on your own ethics of reproducing mm-hmm. this, and so how you're thinking about the reparative work that can be done by reproducing the very images that you're calling into, you're critiquing.
Oh yes, absolutely. This chapter was the one that really made me reflect on my own research ethics. So for the first couple chapters of the book, it was always how knowledge production by experts who are exploiting prisoners. And then I analyze bioethicists who are themselves also producing knowledge that is supposed to serve prisoners, but then ends up not really doing that. And that led me to think like, well, what am I doing? I'm also entering the prison and I'm studying it. And it made me think about, you know, the long work of scholars and activists studying these spaces. We actually don't want to study this anymore. We just want it gone. You know, the object of our research, we don't want it to exist, really. And so what does it mean to produce knowledge about a thing that you're trying to dismantle so you don't have to produce knowledge about it anymore? What does that look like? And so I didn't answer it in the book. I was totally, because I felt like I was unprepared to do so. But what does a bioethics, an abolitionist bioethics, look like? And my gesture towards an answer would be, you know, what was happening before the Bioethics Commission began their investigations. We had the civil rights movement. We had the Black Power movement. We had Black leaders being targeted, assassinated, or incarcerated. And so it seems that the demands of Black Power were not reformist in the way that bioethics demands were in relation to the prison. And so that's, I try to maintain that abolitionist approach to STS in the book by ending on that note and preserving it. I have now analyzed the internal workings of medical science in prisons. And so, you know, what the Black Power movement offers in their uncompromising statement of armed self-defense against the state, you know, and systemic change, the eradication of a prison nation, what would that look like for those of us who study the sciences, who critique the sciences, and who want to formulate ethical practices in relation to sciences and then in relation to our own work? What would that look like? So the book ends with that. I don't answer it. I'm starting to get a better idea of what that might look like in my newer work now. And so I feel like I'm more prepared to answer that question now, but definitely in the book, it's kind of where I end. And I'm sorry for that, that it's unsatisfying.
No, I think it's very inviting. I mean, the entire notion of a reparative bioethics, I mean, how to even think about that. And Reagan, I wonder if you could kind of wrap us up on that issue as well.
In chapter 4, you mentioned how prison participation in experiments might have constituted a form of empowerment and enabled prisoners to mitigate the coercive nature of imprisonment. This presented an interesting turn in the discussion, as most of the chapter draws attention to the prisoner's inherent lack of power during prison experimentation. You touched on this a little bit earlier, but could you explain for our listeners whether you think there is a real possibility of empowerment for prisoners, or is prisoner agency an illusion?
I wouldn't call it an illusion. I think there are pockets of agency that are very specific to imprisonment that is possible. I want to say that. But let me think about this for a second. This is a good question. Could you repeat a little bit of it again?
Yeah, of course. I said, could you explain for our listeners whether you think there is a real possibility of empowerment for prisoners, or is agency an illusion?
Yes. So what I would say is that the prison space creates desperate conditions of survival. And so forms of agency that can be theorized in this space has to take that into account, that exercises of these agency are being done in desperate conditions. But then we can also ask, is that agency, if it is done in desperate conditions? Because in bioethics, isn't that called coercion? And so the language that we use, the frameworks that we use to talk about agency shifts, like, what is agency here, you know, and what would agency do, you know, for us? For the Bioethics Commission, what was very important for them was to imagine a prison subject who was like other subjects of abuse. So someone who is a subject of human rights. So their approach to making medical science experiments in prison more ethical is through reform, right? Maybe if there were more jobs in prisons and if they paid better, maybe more prisoners wouldn't feel so pressured to participate in these research programs. Maybe if we had more doctors and nurses and trained medical staff in prisons, prisoners wouldn't join these experiments just so they could receive medical attention and care. Maybe if prison conditions weren't so violent, prisoners wouldn't join these programs just so they could have a relatively safer space in prisons. Maybe if prison life or prison existence wasn't so empty, you know, where people are just passing the time, maybe they wouldn't feel pressure to join these research programs just so they can do something, right? So that's a reformist approach. How do we make the prison space a better space for these kinds of things? That's a definition of agency and empowerment that I am trying to critique in the book, because even the Federal Bureau of Prisons were like, no, we're just going to summarily end these programs in our prisons because we don't want to adopt these reforms, because that defeats the purpose of imprisonment. Because the prison is supposed to be this dehumanizing. So even the Federal Bureau of Prisons say, no, they're not supposed to have this idea of agency that you think that they should have. So that's a very good question. I think that to think about the possibility of agency, we have to define what we mean by that first.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That basically we can't tweak our way to abolition.
Yes.
That's not how it works. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation and really for your remarkable book. It really brought together, I think, in important and helpful ways, generative ways for us, the relationship between knowledge, between science and freedom. And one of the things that you say towards the end of the book is that what you're really trying to do here in this part, in this project, and I think a lot of us are behind you on this, so really rallying behind you, is to push the liberatory limits of political legibility towards the eradication of a prison nation. So thanks so much for showing us how that can be done. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So this has been an interview by Laura Stark,
Lali Padilla, Halcyon Guy,
Justin McLean,
Reagan Kelly,
and Sonali Perlman.